the AHDB podcast, farming news and stories from across the UK.
Welcome everyone to this AHDB podcast. I'm Nick Renison and today I'm joined by Kalina Humphreys up in Perthshire. We're going to be talking about Kalina's grazing journey and I hope you enjoy it. Kalina, it's an amazing day here. The baler's going outside and I hope it's the same with you.
Well, rather unusually, Nick, it is. It's blue sky. We cut and made silage 2 days ago, baled it last night. Everything is beautifully dry and we haven't made a mark on the fields. It's fantastic.
And it's kind of heaven sent and slight. It feels slightly odd that silage time or hay time isn't a complete stress. Can you just tell us a little bit about you and the farm and just a bit about your backstory?
Yeah, well, I'm a sheep farmer. We are in the central belt of Scotland, just off the A9 for those of you who travel north. At any point, you've probably gone past us within about 10 minutes if you've gone up the A9. We're just over 200 hectares. It's a sheep-only unit. Been in the family for a long time, or part of which owned by my bit of the family. The rest we rent from other bits of the family. And I'm in partnership with my husband, Jonathan. But he also has his own family business, which is at the opposite end of the country. So we switch between the two, which makes for interesting work-life balance. Two teenagers, been around a lot recently, obviously, because they've been locked in. Thankfully, not at the moment. We've got a little over 1,000 ewes, went to the tup last year, plus a varying number of hogs or an increasing number of hogs that go to the tup. It was 250 last year. And I take in some summer grazing cattle. They come here for their summer holidays on in May and off at the end of August, depending on grass. Could take a lot more, but that's what we're doing at the moment. And I've been doing rotational grazing, which I completely love, for about 5 years properly and completely love it.
You're a convert.
I'm a total convert. A bit of a grass nerd, really. Spend a lot of time looking right down under my feet as opposed to the blue sky or the grey sky mainly.
So can you just talk to us about your Murray roll-off moment? Because I don't think at that point, I think the farm was maybe being run by a shepherd, was that right? And Then you were just starting to think that you needed to come back full time.
Yeah, I was definitely, from the point when my father died, which now is over 10 years ago, we became involved, increasingly involved in the farm remotely, then on a part-time basis. And then when the shepherd was leaving, we had to make a decision about what we did. And I did have an itch to have a go myself. I felt we didn't really have a very easy system. And there is nothing like doing it yourself. And we talked about it and came to the conclusion that we would have a go. And so that was back in 2016. I was already getting involved and thinking about grazing and going to some meetings. This particular one that you're referring to, I think, was run by the Soil Association in July 2014. So it's 7 years ago. And they'd invited Murray Roloff to come across and speak. And it was held at Michael Blanche's farm at Colchaka up near Perth. And that was the first time where I saw a paddock grazing system in practice, miles of electric fencing, saw what a paddock looked like that had been grazed that day or 3 days ago or 5 days ago, and what the a physical difference that you could see. And then listened to Murray speak. And he really struck a chord with me, and it was the archetypal light bulb moment. And having gone to that meeting, we went back and agreed we'd stick up an electric fence or two. So it started back then, but in a fairly small and pretty amateurish way. And it still is amateurish because you're learning the whole time.
But at that point, what did the farming system look like prior to electric fences?
It was much fewer ewes, which is, it is amazing. So I think back then it was maybe less than 800 ewes. Indoor lambing system, set stocked, coming indoors in January when the grass ran out and being indoors all the way to lambing, during lambing and then turned out. So I suppose quite traditional in that sense. Very poor performance. But that was not just, it wasn't just to do with perhaps the grazing management not being as good as it could have been back then. We did discover, we were scratching our heads because the performance wasn't good, and discovered about that time a lurking Mighty Visner problem, which actually turned out to be a big Mighty Visner problem. and did a whole load of blood testing, I think in the back end of 2015, and discovered, yeah, it was pretty widespread. So of course, by that stage, the TUPS were already out, and we had to live with that knowledge right through that 2016 lambing.
How was your scan affected? Was it really?
Well, the scan was always poor. I mean, it was mature ewes doing, I don't know, 140% or something, and you know, rearing. I mean, things just used to die basically, because Mighty Visna is, if your listeners perhaps don't know terribly much about it, is one of those iceberg diseases that really affects all sorts of things, but colostrum quality being one of them. You know, and colostrum is gold, and so things just lambs used to die. The survivability was really, really poor, and the ewes, you know, the cull rate was also huge. So we split the flock at scanning time and lambed separately, a clean flock and a dirty flock. And then after weaning that year, I was very lucky. I'd heard about a Mighty Visna, an MV accredited flock that was downsizing, and we did a massive cull and restocked. So our improvement in performance over the last 5 years, yes, has definitely been to do with being able to manage our grazing better and have a better system overall. But it is also definitely to do with eradicating a big health problem, which just hadn't been spotted or dealt with.
That must have been an app just awful to deal with mentally.
Well, I remember putting what looked like perfectly good ewes on a lorry to go to market to be sold cull, and just feeling awful. And you just have to try not to think about it and just move on. And now, actually, when I look at the flock and they are, you know, I always wonder why everybody else had big, glossy, healthy ewes. And then, you know, then I realise why, because ours weren't either big, glossy or healthy. And now, and I can look at the ewes, you know, with pride and know that they're in good nick, and we're doing the best for them, really.
So. And as far as I'm assuming you probably breed your own replacements now.
Yes, we do. And we did then. So we do primarily, the base of the flock is a clun or a clun cross. And then the last few years, our maternal breed has been a Highlander. So we've got a lot of Highlander cross ewes in the flock now. And then it's a Texel or a Texel cross Charolais that is used on the commercial side. So last year to the TUP, in very round terms, 500 ewes went to maternal, 500 ewes went to a commercial TUP. We just ran two tupping mobs and then a mob of hogs separately. Yeah. Which when we come on to talking about rotation, the smaller number of mobs you have to rotate, the simpler life you will have, not simpler than you will be, but it definitely is an easier system to manage when you've got only a few mobs of sheep to deal with.
And just going back to when you buy in rams, are you,
yes,
what do you do there? I know you've obviously been kind of hit with MV once, you'd be ultra protective, I'm assuming.
Yes, and I think, although we don't really know, because I think this MV could have been around for years and years and years, it probably did come in with TUPS, but we don't know, but maybe very long time ago. I only buy from on farm, basically, and we're very, very careful about who we buy from, known sources, and strict quarantine when they come onto farm.
Going back to electric fences, so you started putting electric fences up.
Yes.
So tell us about those early days of electric fences, and also water, I'm assuming, as well, your water system.
Yeah. Though with sheep, it wasn't quite such an immediate issue as it would be if we were trying to rotate cattle, obviously. So if I look back at my farm map from 2016, say, of that 200 hectares that we've got, just under 90 is on what I call my grazing platform. And back in 2016, we had 18 fields. So it was, you know, everything was about 5 hectares, which is not, yeah, those fields are not big. This farm was a dairy farm once upon a time, going way back. So, you know, the fields were never very big. So that in itself was a help to us. You know, we weren't dealing with 100 acre or 50 acre fields. So we used a lot from field to field, and they all had water sources in them. So we started simply by putting up a three-wire poly wire fence through the middle of those. So, you know, 5 hectares went to 2.5, immediately doubling your options of where to graze. It is a bit like your farm gets bigger.
Yeah.
That's how it feels. Yep. And I've done a lot more sort of semi-permanent subdivision of the more outer reaches of the farm as well, which also helps. What it gives you is the ability to rest grass, and that is the key, really. So I probably have the maximum subdivisions up in the back end, so October, November, to in the that run-up to tupping, is where I have built up quite a lot of grass covers, really. From pretty soon I will be starting to think about it, August, September time is when I'm building up that grass that I'm going to eat in.
Yeah, so that's the bit October, that we're now in kind of mid July.
Yeah.
And already you're thinking 3-4 months ahead, aren't you, really?
I am. Yeah. It really starts early. And as soon as you're into that October, November period, you're already thinking about what's going to be there in March, April for your spring rotation. So, I mean, the whole thing just runs, you know, one into the other. So we obviously have this massive surplus of grass now, which is where our silage is coming from, because the grass is probably growing at, well, look at GrassCheck to have a guide. I'm not very good at working out my own specific growth on the farm.
But, I think,
60 kilos.
Yeah, 60, I would think it would be around 60, like 65.
But it wasn't that long ago. This year was a very slow spring for everybody, I think.
Yeah.
So the growth back in April was virtually non-existent. May, I think early May, we were perhaps doing 10 kilos when it should have been going ballistic, but just wasn't because it was so cold. Mid-May, 20 maybe. So we had a very, very late magic day, which magic day being the day when our demand, our supply of grass finally exceeds our demand, and we start to build up surpluses. And that's when you're thinking about dropping paddocks out to take them for silage. I mean, now, yes, we're doing 60, 70 kilos. So, you know, I've already cut 6 or 7 paddocks this year, and we've got about 450 bales done for next winter. We need over 600. So we're quite a long way there in quite quick order, actually. So we've gone definitely from famine to feast in a pretty short time with that spike in the growth curve.
And so then you mentioned magic day, and we're talking about demands and kilograms of dry matter and wedges and all that kind of stuff. So I'm assuming that you had loads to learn, and you had to learn that relatively quickly. Can you just talk a little bit about the Monitor Farms and also the legend that is Michael Blanch?
His head will be getting very big, won't it?
I love him.
First of all, to Murray Roloff, the thing that Murray Roloff said that really stuck with me, and it leads on to what the grazing Monitor Farms did through Quality Meat Scotland, and which Michael Blanch and others ran, was that you have to try and control what you can control within your farm gate. And one thing you really can control is, or try to control, is the digestibility of the grass that you're growing. You know, that is that you can manage and control it, stop it going to seed, stop it going woody, keep it in that young leafy condition, which is so much more full of sugar and is highly digestible. And the other thing that you can control is how much of that grass you utilize by using fences, by allocating it correctly. So those are the things that was part of my light bulb was that thing of, you know, controlling the things that you can control. So at that stage, yes, I was having to start to learn this language, which is understanding that, you know, grass is not just grass. Grass is actually just dry matter. It's you take the water away, and that's what actually holds the nutrition. And that's what you're trying to convert into protein and cash profit via sheep and cattle. So I then, you know, whenever I was able to, I started going to the QMS Perthshire grazing group, which was based with Alex Brewster at Rockmell. Yep. He was a great advocate for trying stuff, and if it doesn't work, you know, rip it out and try it again. And those meetings were invaluable for teaching you and actually seeing somebody having a go and what effect it was having on the performance of their livestock and the profitability of their farm. And it allowed me to meet lots and lots of people many of whom I've stayed in touch with and who are a source of support and information. You know, Michael being, you know, one of the ones at the top of the list, who is, you know, has really become my mentor and probably to a lot of people, actually, not least of all through the Pasture Pod, obviously.
Oh, yes, I know. He's just got a great skill. He's got a gift of just communicating and bringing people together, I suppose. So how does your relationship with him as a kind of consultant work?
So probably 2-3 years ago now, having met him through the grazing groups, I got him onto the farm and, you know, I told him all about my system, my problems and all the things I wanted to do, and got him to do a written report for me, and which I do reread quite often because it was, you know, a lot of harsh words in black and white. And, you know, we've moved on from that, and he comes onto the farm maybe, you know, 2 or 3 times a year, but he's also on the end of a phone. So quite often I'm puzzling something out of, should I do this or should I do that? And I might even have made up my mind, but I want to sound him out, you know. So I'll ring him up and we'll talk it through, and he'll say, you already know the answer to this, maybe. And I said, well, this is what I think I should do. And he goes, yes or no. Yeah. So, but you know, there are others that fall into that category on a more informal basis. In other words, I'm part of a couple of WhatsApp groups where, you know, we share information and can ask questions without fear of embarrassment, of looking a bit of an idiot, because there are no stupid questions and everybody's learning the whole time how to do this thing of rotational grazing. So
I think that's what is so nice about the kind of the farmers that come together, and it's all helping each other, isn't it? And you're right, there isn't a stupid question.
No. And there's a huge amount of information now. I think the internet has been revolutionary in terms of the amount of information. So the I was an early user of the AHDB better returns information, which, you know, just having come from outside the industry, you know, farming, there's so much information, good information, researched information there for you to tap into and learn from, at the cost of the levy payer.
You're dead right.
You just take a levy and it's fantastic. You know, you don't get that in other industries. We are spoiled, I think, in that regard.
No, totally. So can you just talk us through the golden 20 days? We do it here and it's made a huge difference to us. Can you just explain?
Okay, so we're talking about the run up to tupping. First of all, there is a golden period before lambing as well, but we're talking about the run-up to tupping. So in our particular instance, what I'm aiming to do from August, September onwards is build up this wedge of grass, which I am then going to allocate and feed out to the ewes in that period. For me, it's the start of November, because the tups go out, you know, maybe the 18th of November. So I'm trying not to graze at all my grazing platform in October, partly by, I do sell quite a lot of store lambs. So I'm trying to push store lambs out the door to reduce the demand to increase the covers that I've got. And the ewes actually from weaning, if they're fit and up to condition, will get maintained on these sort of outer parts of the farm on sort of lesser, just maintenance type grazing. And then they will come back onto the grazing platform in late October, beginning of November, and I will shift them daily. That's really what the 20 golden days is all about. It's about giving them the right amount of grass. Daily is the most efficient, particularly when you've got high covers and you don't want them trampling a lot of what could be good grazing by sticking around too long. They want to basically eat what's under their feet and move on the next day to the next fresh bit. And I believe they do say that cattle or sheep, but a ewe will find a better diet for herself than you could give her. You know, she's selecting the best yummy bits out of what you offer on a daily basis. And so I'm doing that really all of that beginning of November. So in fact, I probably do 15 days before the tups go out, something like that. And then it's very important you give them that same choice of really good fresh grass. And I continue to do daily shifts, even during tupping, at least up to about day 10. So I think the original 20 days that Trevor Cook talked about was 10 days pre and the first 10 days of tupping. And then it becomes less important because, you know, you've had your ovulation and hopefully things have really got going. And as we all know, most things are covered. You know, the vast majority of the ewes are probably covered in that first, you know, 10 to 15 days. There won't be much goes into the second cycle.
And how big would your tupping mobs typically be?
Well, as big as possible, if you want a simple life. So I do. So if I go back a step and go to the pre-tupping, I might have virtually all my mature ewes in one mob, because that is so efficient, you know, and I'd be just, they're in slightly bigger areas. I could be going around with maybe not quite 1,000, but I have done it at nearly 1,000 in a mob. You know, it's quite daunting. It's quite daunting, but more probably like 750, and probably keep the gimmers separate. But maybe I have done it where I've put the gimmers in front and the ewes behind earlier on, and then they maybe have separate rotations. And then they go into their tupping mobs, and the tupping mob pretty much is 500, two lots of 500, and then a mob of hogs separately. So we'd have to have three groups going round. And that means the benefit of that, of having those big mobs and the small number of mobs, is that once they've moved through your paddocks that you've allocated to them on this rotation, that first paddock that you've grazed, maybe at the very end of October, that's it, it's done its job. And you don't have to go back there again. In fact, you don't want to go back there again, because you want to leave what's there. And there is great debate about this, about how much you should leave and how much you lose through winter kill, which you do definitely do a bit. But that's the first paddock I go back to on the mid-March. So you're moving round, this huge mob moving round, and you'll get to the end of, in my case, get to my end of my rotation about Christmas time. But by that time, those early paddocks will already have been rested for 50-60 days perhaps.
Because I think it's very often the case where you go kind of February, March time in more conventional systems, everywhere is absolutely, there's just nothing anywhere, is there? No cover anywhere. And we, you know, farmers kind of think, oh, well, it'll start growing in April, May. But this is totally doing things differently, isn't it?
It's doing things differently, and rest is the key. Yeah. You try to give everything 120 days rest. I never used to be able to get it. You think, how can I possibly find 120 days? But that is how you do it. You have these big mobs and you move through and across the farm, and those early paddocks, you don't go back to them. And it's so hard to resist because you get to December and you know, and I know that I had some quite big covers still left because we had a good November last year, good early. We still had some growth in November. Wasn't much, but you could see that those early grazed paddocks had regrown during November, and it was very, very tempting to go around again. But, and that's probably when I have these conversations with Michael, which is, do you, don't you, you know, what do you do? So I mean, I know for sure that the very first paddock that I go into in the spring and the first one I come out of in the autumn had a cover, if this means anything to anybody, of 2,000 kilos of dry matter, which is huge.
Yeah, which is about 20
centimetres. How many centimetres would that be? Yeah, a lot.
Yeah.
In the autumn, that would be, I've got my QMS sword stick here, 2,000 kilos, more like, yeah, nine centimetres. So it's quite, you know, it's a quite a high cover. And, you know, we have a bit of discussion this, and you definitely lose an element of that over the winter period. You do, leaves do die off. But I think the important thing is that the roots have got reserves, and that grass does get going quicker in the spring. And so it was the first paddock I grazed on the 15th of March with a big mob, 400 and something, 450 mature twins went onto that field. And I can remember grazing it and being disappointed that it didn't look great, and it definitely didn't look, you know, it probably had more like 1750 on it by that stage, but there's still, that was a massive amount of grass for that time of year. And I grazed it for a day, probably down to 1250. And a week later, because we had quite good weather at the end of March, you know, you could see the regrowth had come back. It's a bit like that thing, you know, when you, if you're a gardener, you cut your grass for the first time in the year And then irritatingly, it grows again. And you think, oh God, now I've got to cut my grass every week. Well, it's that action of eating that grass that is part of the stimulus for getting it going, I think.
Yeah. No, I think you're dead right. So we've got the golden 20. So that's tupping. And then we spoke earlier about how you've put some bales out. You made some silage yesterday and you put some bales out on some rough ground. So after they finish that tupping rotation, they then go on to bale grazing. So can you just talk us through that?
Yeah, so there is a little bit of an interim bit of grazing on sort of rough, rushy pasture, which we've got. So I definitely try and get off my grazing platform Christmas, mid-December or towards Christmas. And hopefully there is a bit more kind of rougher grazing on the outer bits of the farm, my kind of buffer zone, which might last me another couple of weeks, possibly. We started feeding silage. We roughly start feeding silage around about New Year. If I can get into the new year, then that's great. I don't really try and, I definitely used to try and delay it. You know, I thought that was a good thing to do, but actually, I don't think it's like that. I think I'm quite happy to go on to silage when I need to go on to silage because I'm coming off silage earlier than I was. So we never used to start grazing until the beginning of April, but I've bought that by managing the grazing in the back end. I've bought, hopefully in an average year anyway, it could be covered in a foot of snow, you know, there's always that possibility. But on average, I hope I've bought that extra 2 weeks pre-lambing, which is just grass in their diet, and I'm not having to supplement them at all. If there's sufficient grass, the grass quality will be there. If there's sufficient quantity of grass there, I shouldn't be having to supplement them at all. So yeah, so I start feeding silage, beginning of January, but for all the mature ewes, that is definitely fed in situ out on the outer parts of the farm, the rougher, rushy, brackeny bits at the top of the farm, which don't matter too much. And I get the contractor at the time of cutting that silage to cart it and set it out on a grid. And if you look on Twitter, you might, on my Twitter account, you might see the old picture of it. So they're probably set out 6 metres apart, maybe. And I've learnt, having done it now for several years, that I just do two rows along the edge of a field. So I've got one permanent fence or a hot wire fence or something along one side. And then I use electric to go around the other three sides. And say I have a mob of 400 mature ewes running as one mob. I will allocate, it'll be 40 ewes to a bale. So I will open 10 bales at a time and they're set out maybe 6 metres apart. So they've got this grid and nothing goes into that field mechanically other than me and the quad bike. And I have to, obviously have to get the ring feeders there, but I just roll the ring, cut the bales, get rid of the plastic. I leave that disc underneath, obviously, because they're sitting on their beak. And I simply roll the ring over and then peel away the electric fence and leave it round just the uneaten bales. And then the ewes come in and they will probably eat that allocated bit of silage in about 4 days, 4 or 5 days. So they're only ever in one concentrated area for 4 or 5 days. And yes, in wet weather, it can get a bit muddy, but then they're moving on to the next 10 bales. Yeah. Which is, you know, 30 metres further up the fence. So there's no standing round a ring feeder that's been there for weeks and weeks and weeks. It isn't like that. And I've learned also that I set these bales out along the edges of big areas. So, you know, 10 hectare of rush pasture where the ewes have got plenty scope to go and sit on a dry, clean, dry area and get a dry lie away from where they're eating. And they do that, you know, they sit up on the hill and then they come down and eat and then go away off and sit. And they do
So you can, in theory, get through the whole winter without having to start a tractor.
On that outside stuff, yeah, that is for sure. I don't, there's one of the things I hate doing is making a mess with a tractor. I don't like tractors anyway. I'm a silly girl. I hate them. The teenagers love them. I don't like them at all. We do have a tractor. I have to say, there are two mobs or two classes of stock that I have decided are better indoors because we do have some buildings. And so I have two sets of buildings and I choose to have indoors the Gimmers as a mob and the hogs as a mob, because it's, I have limited places where I can do this kind of outdoor shed silage grid system. I've limited places, and I don't like mixing the age groups because they don't, you know, they get out-competed, they get bullied. And I've just found I can control, you know, the condition of these and the growth of these two young classes of stock better by having them indoors. That's just the way I do it. If I had more space, I would have them in a separate group somewhere else and have them on bale grazing. And I have done it in the past, but that's what I choose to do. So to answer your question is, we do have a forklift, we've got a Merlot. And so bales are fed in the same way in a line of five or six bales at a time with ring feeders, which I roll over. But those bales are taken in probably twice a week. And I try to be very organised, and I try and feed on a Monday and a Thursday and not every day of the week, because, you know, I've got limited time and I don't want to be feeding every day of the week.
That sounds the way to do it.
Yeah.
And so just quickly, we have trouble with crows pecking the bales, just a lot of trouble with that. You don't?
No, I don't know why we don't. I really don't know why we don't. Obviously, the bales are sitting on their bean can, so, you know, they are protected by much thicker layers of plastic on that top. We've never had a problem. The only problem I have is when I'm lax and I let a mob of sheep into where those bales are sitting waiting for winter, and for some bizarre reason they decide, rather than eat the grass that's there, they are going to have a go at the bales. But that's my mess up, not anybody else's, because I don't always get around to putting the electric fence around them when I should do. So the only damage I've ever had to deal with, I do know that other people do have problems with birds, and they've got around that problem by painting, you know, used oil or something nasty on top of the bales, and it's become less of an issue. But we know, it's, you know, we've got plenty of other problems, but that's not one of them.
That's not one of your problems. So then going on then to the pre-lambing rotation, you're start lambing on the 15th of April.
Yep.
So when do you start your pre-lambing rotation?
So I've got so from scanning, which is at the beginning of February, I should also say I'll probably have the triplets indoors between scanning at the beginning of February and the 15th of March, which is my target date for getting triplets and twin bearing ewes back on rotation. Now this year we did manage that. So the triplets were inside and on just silage, but the best silage I had, so, you know, 12 ME rocket fuel, and did very well on it and didn't have anything else other than rock salt. We do give rock salt. And the twin bearing ewes went back, came off their bales and went onto rotation on the 15th of March, and they did this quick rotation, and I started set stocking them on about the 10th of April. When they start dropping lambs, you know it's time to set stock. And by that time, you know, hopefully some of the paddocks will have been grazed fairly recently, because in that rotation by nature, but the ones that have been grazed back on the 15th March, by the 10th of April, you know, I definitely had regrowth on them. So I should also say that, because we haven't mentioned nitrogen, the nasty word nitrogen, and I'm not a nitrogen user, really, other than reseeds or fertiliser user at all, apart from reseeding. But strategically, just in the last 2 years, I have put a real sprinkle, and I do mean a sprinkle, so 100 kilograms to the hectare of 27 plus sulphur in the back end, so end of August, just spread, you know, that's a very low rate, to boost my covers in the back end. That was the first time I ever did it, and I reckon I got a really good return. I probably got an extra 500 kilos of dry matter cover, which was fantastic. So that was important. And then the other thing I do, and again, this is absolutely the first time I've done it, and it was a sprinkle, literally, with a spinner on the back of the quad bike onto the paddocks that I grazed or was going to graze pre-lambing. Again, it was quite good weather, and it was, you know, 100 kilos to the hectare of 27 mil. It definitely helped boost the little bit of growth that we were getting. So it was really strategic. I don't put fertilizer and nitrogen on silage ground. You know, we don't do that traditional setting up and thing. It's all surplus grass, really. And we do put K back on after we cut. So those are the things. And we lime, obviously. We aim for the 15th of March. and we did achieve it. And yeah, we set stocking about the 10th of April, and it's on, you know, not hugely high covers really, but enough. But because the because it was so cold this year, and every year is going to be different in April, I held the gimmers back. I had a bit of silage. I held the gimmers back. They stayed indoors probably for another week after the ewes went on, and then they went on to rotation. And the singles are stashed away on eating cardboard. Yeah. Well out of the way. And the hogs did, you know, they get preferential treatment as well. So they were held a little bit longer indoors because, again, I still had good silage. And then when I felt I had enough grass there to get me to the set stocking point, they then went on to a bit of a rotation as well. So, okay. So everything probably was outdoors by the 1st of April, I would say. So at least 2 days.
And so with one of your many things you've done in the past is be an accountant, and how when you're doing all this planning, and how conscious are you of the cost? Does that really come into it?
Well, I mean, for sure, grass, you know, it isn't rocket science. You don't have to be an accountant to know that what's growing under your feet is the cheapest, probably the best balanced diet that you can give your stock. And as soon as you start wrapping something in plastic or metal, you're putting metal between you and the bit of livestock. That's another great Michael Blanche phrase, putting metal between the livestock and what it's eating. You're putting cost into your system. And we definitely had a very cost heavy system. You know, when you've got, I mean, I do admit I've got strategically got sheep in buildings which have to, you know, be bedded properly and then require mucking out. I would dearly love not to be doing any of that. I would dearly love everything to be outside. But that, you know, those are strategic decisions, and I think costs worth bearing because I'm getting a better grown hog.
Yeah.
A lamb better. I'm definitely doing my hogs better and getting them to good, better tupping weights every year that I'm doing it, and obviously then lambing at better weights, and they go on to being better gimmers. And the gimmers are still growing as well. So that's a strategic decision. But yeah, you have to think, you have to trust in the grass, which I've never been very good at. And it's probably something that Michael, you know, is always saying, you've got to have confidence in it. You've got to trust it, that it will do everything you need it to do for that ewe, provided you're giving it in sufficient quantity in that run up to lambing or in that run up to tupping. You know, you shouldn't be having to reach to open a bag.
No.
If you can avoid it. And, you know, that by that very nature, you don't need to do the sums because, you know, that isn't rocket science.
Well, I always think it's when we used to have lorries coming up the road with feed, and it's thousands of pounds worth, isn't it? Every time you see it coming up the drive, it's a big check to sign, isn't it? And it is.
You have to think. I think there is a shift in mentality to thinking of hard feed. It's not the devil by any means, because there is a place for it, but go to thinking of it as supplementing what you're already doing, as opposed to being a replacement. Or that it is the feed itself, that's what they're existing on, and without it they would suffer. I definitely have fed barley through 3-in-1 feeders, and I still do, to strategically, particularly to the hogs, because sometimes that, you know, I haven't got sufficient quantity, or they need more than I can give them, and it definitely works. And you know, and there is a place for creep feeding, you know, strategically. Yeah. You know, all those things, I try not to think of them as the devil, because they're not. But my main food source is grass or silage. And I should mention, I've even come away from growing forage crops.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to move on to next, because and you mentioned Alec Brewster, and he's good at trying things. And if they don't work, you don't have to carry on with things, do you? And I think that's
it. You've got to work out what works for you, and what works for you won't necessarily work. We'll probably see madness to the next person because their farm is different and their priorities may be different. For me, another thing that was, I think it might have been something that Liz Jenever said to the Nellises, possibly. I'm trying to think back.
Listen, yes, no. Plus,
you write down the three things that you hate doing, or that you know, whatever. And my three things were growing a forage crop, which I found extremely stressful and very, very hit and miss. The second thing was efficiently feeding out that forage crop, you know, strip grazing it. Super stressful, never ever worked. You know, the fence shorts out, they go and eat the next day's ration, ration, and, you know, before you know it, what you thought you had, you haven't got. And the third thing is driving tractors across wet ground. So those were my three things. And we were never very good. You know, we do finish lambs. Lambs do finish. But also, I want a fairly easy autumn. That's my choice. My priority is the ewes and the hogs that I want to get to the tup. So I went away from growing a forage crop. I was trying to concentrate stock onto forage crops in September, October, but I wasn't ever growing enough of it successfully for them ever to be on it long enough for it to be of real benefit. By the time they transitioned onto it and got used to it, it was all gone. So it was a super stressful waste of time. So I've given up, and I now just that's where the putting a bit of nitrogen on in late August came into play, because I thought I'd rather do that and manage my white clover and ryegrass better, which, you know, has got a degree of certainty about it. It's there. I know it's going to grow if I manage it properly, than have this really expensive hit and miss operation that I was trying to do, which it just didn't work for me. It works for plenty of people, but I could never get it right. You know, it worked occasionally, but it didn't work enough consistently enough for me. So yeah, so that's gone. So that's why there's a bit of nitrogen goes on at the end of August. From last year was the first year I didn't have a forage crop. Oh, and I was a much happier bunny, much happier.
A much happier autumn bunny.
Yes.
So one of the points, and I think we've got the point across, it's that it's with the grazing, it's planning, isn't it? You've got to really be thinking ahead all the time when it can initially seem a bit weird. Like I said before, we are here in July. It's gorgeous. Yes. There's loads of grass. But you're thinking about tupping time.
I'm thinking about it. And I do keep records. People keep records in all sorts of different ways. Some people use Pharmax. Some people are measuring their grass with a plate meter and using Agrinet. I have to say I've tried all those things. And I have come back to, I've always had a spreadsheet with all my fields down the x-axis and time on the y-axis. And I just block out with colours when each field is grazed with a mob, you know, 3 days and then shifting. It's a very visual record for me. So I know you can actually lose track of time as to did that mob go in there on Monday? Did it go in there on Sunday? I can't remember. You know, they've already been in there for 2 days, and it helps you work out your rotation length, so you're not coming back too quickly to something that was, you know, might look fantastic, but it might only have been grazed 10 days ago, and you want to give it that rest. Maybe you want to give it, you know, 20 days rest. So it helps me visualize that. And I do use that. And I do try and keep a record of my average farm cover at certain points of the year, and work out how many days grazing ahead I've got. That's another thing I do. But I just do it all in spreadsheets. You know, you could do it on paper. You don't have to have anything fancy, really.
Yeah, you're dead right. So this is a rather deep question, Lena. So it's two kind of questions. I can tell by your voice that you just love it. Mm-hmm. And did you ever think you'd love it this much?
No, I had no comprehension I would enjoy my job as much as I do. I am completely addicted to it. Would I enjoy it as much if we weren't managing the grass and the farm the way we are? I'm a bit of a control freak, really, and I do like the feeling of control that rotational grazing gives you. One of the best feelings in the world is that moment when you've got a big mob of ewes or big mob of ewes and lambs or hogs or whatever, and they've grazed, they've been some in the paddock for 2-3 days or might only be for a day, they've got it down, and you drop that electric fence and they're going into that kind of wonderful carpet of clover next door, and that noise that they make, there's a huge job satisfaction in that. I think that you are doing absolutely the best for your stock, and they're getting everything that they need to be healthy and thrive, and as a result make you profit. You know, let's not forget you can't survive without profit. So, you know, I know I do really enjoy it. I'm glad that's coming across. You know, it might come across as being obsessive to closer members of the family.
Well, Michael's he's obviously the consultancy's working. You're becoming, yes. Well, you, yeah.
He's got a convert, definitely got a convert. Yeah.
Success. And what areas are you looking to, is there bits that you think, oh, I need to work on that? I need to kind of, they're my weaker spots.
Yeah, well, the top of my list actually is that I'm a sheep only unit, and that is a big weakness. That's historical. It's been safe. You know, it's what I know. We only take in summer grazing cattle and to eat a bit of surplus. They're just a grazing management tool. They don't leave a lot of money behind them because they're, you know, I'm only getting a rate per head per week basis. But it does give me huge flexibility as to when they come on and when they go off, which helps me manage the grass. But I'm constantly worried about the fact that I am a sheep only system. I would love to have a clean grazing system, which really means that I'd have to have a significant number of cattle on the farm to allow me to have that break and give certain areas a break from sheep. So that I haven't yet decided how I'm going to do that. The easiest thing would be trading stock, but trading cattle, but that is not for the faint-hearted, and I haven't got my head around that yet. So yeah, so that's my next project, but I can see it's fast disappearing this year, but it has to come. There has to be a balance between cattle and sheep, and I don't have it at the moment. I would say that there has been a shift generally across the people in my, were originally in my grazing group, that there aren't many that are sheep only units. And those that had both, there has been a bit of a shift towards cattle ratio as opposed to sheep. And I think it probably makes your life easier, and you might bear that point out.
Yeah. Well, I think just when we had a lot of sheep, when we were completely, well, like you are now, but I think you probably got more land. We just had a worm burden that we couldn't really shift.
It worries me. It worries me that we will lose over time, we'll lose the effectiveness of the anthelmintics that we've got. And farming without them would be, sheep farming without them would be extremely difficult without using nature to help us control the worm burden.
And the mixed grazing, it is a fantastic tool. Well, I'm just conscious that I've kept you for a long time on this. You should be out there doing something.
Yeah.
So just lastly, how do people, if people want to follow you on Twitter, what's your handle?
At Humph Kalina, I believe. Humph, being short for Humphrey, H-U-M-P-H, Kalina. Colin with an A on the end. I don't put a lot up there, but there's always links to other things. Definitely do that. But there's plenty of people out there to follow that do talk a lot about what they're doing. And it's a fantastic learning tool on Twitter. I think people are really, really good at showing, well, yeah, maybe not showing all their warts, but certainly the bad bits should go up there as well as the good bits.
Well, I think it's just a good community, and then you can direct message people, all kinds of stuff. But yeah. I've really enjoyed that. Thank you very, very much for your time.
It's been great.
Yeah, we'll have to watch this space and see if any cloven hooves arrive.
Thank you.